With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at Marines.com.
Welcome to Early BP. I'm Mike Theron. Last night, the D-backs got back over 500 with a win over the Baltimore Orioles, sparked by Adam Jones.
Two outs, two on, 2-2 count. There goes the runner on first. Walker and a ground ball up the middle center field, base hit. Walker will go to third. Escobar scores. Jones is 3-for-3 tonight. This one an RBI single to make it 6-1.
Jones a three-hit night against his former team. We had a chance to speak to the D-backs right fielder after the game.
You spoke before the game about the importance of this one tonight for you. How good was it for you guys to come out and jump out early?
I'd never spoke on the importance of me personally. I spoke on the importance of a team win, yeah. At this point, we need W's, and, you know, that's most important, you know. And I get it. I played there for 11 years, a long time, but we're fighting for a playoff spot. What's most important is we get these W's, and tonight we start off right, so let's do it tomorrow.
And one of the things for you is that you've been swinging the bat really well over the last 10 days or so. What was the adjustment you made?
Grinding. That's the adjustment. The adjustment is grinding. It's not anything specific. I'm just trying to grind it out. That's pretty much it.
With this team, how much do you believe in this group that there's still a run in it?
Oh, like I said, there's before trade deadline, there's what, 7 days, seven games. For a lot of teams, this next week is very, very important. So we just need to tend to our business.
All right, Adam. Thanks.
Thanks, buddy.
Tonight, the D-backs trying to make it two straight over Baltimore. We'll visit with Torrey Lovello in just a moment, but we'll talk about both these teams in the trade deadline as we visit with a couple of beat writers, John Mioli from the Baltimore Sun and Nick Pecoro from the Arizona Republic. All right, let's start, John. Obviously, the Orioles have been sellers all year. The conversation nationally has been pretty quiet with just about everything. What's the level of activity been like surrounding the Orioles maybe in the last 24 to 48 hours?
Well, I think that as this kind of ramps up and you see the needs that other teams have, everyone wants relievers. Everyone wants controllable pieces, and that's at this point what the Orioles have. They already traded Andrew Cashner, who was really their one remaining rental, and just the fact that they got two 17-year-old Venezuelan players while paying a lot of that money means that they're open for business. That's what it kind of says to me. You know, Michael Givens has pitched really well over the last month or so. He's kind of tough around like Memorial Day, but really good since then. I think that's a piece that, as a relief market shakes out, 2 years of Michael Givens is going to sound pretty intriguing to some of these teams that need back-end help.
For the Diamondbacks, Nick, it's been a lot of different stories. It's been we're going to do one or the other. Then it's been we might try and do both. Now it's we might be leaning one way. What's the latest on what they're looking at as we get closer to the deadline?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of look at the Diamondbacks as like maybe like another NL West team, the San Francisco Giants, kind of one of the most interesting teams approaching the deadline, and kind of a team that's maybe going to, like, once these two teams decide, I think a lot of things are going to start to fall into place around baseball. It sounds to me like the Diamondbacks are kind of leaning towards selling, but I think they also realize that they've got six more games coming up against teams that are on pace for 110 losses in the Orioles and the Marlins, and a chance to, you know, look, they haven't really been able to go on a run, like a prolonged run, in a long time. But, you know, if they go 6-1 in the seven-game stretch and suddenly are, you know, five games over and, you know, right there in the wild card race, it's going to be hard to sell. My sense is from listening to Mike Hazen yesterday, though, he kind of wants to. I don't know that he totally believes in this team. I think he's kind of preparing himself to sell, but is going to let, you know, the rest of the week play out.
I always wonder how much of that is because that's the tougher thing to do, right? You need to have much more information, whereas if you're buying, especially in their situation, you're looking probably for incremental upgrades. It's not necessarily going to be the star player in that. And so I wonder if that's where part of that comes across that way.
It could be. I mean, I think, yeah, like you said, I mean, they're probably going to be, if they're going to be buying, it'll be rentals. It'll be, you know, a guy that they'll be taking on for a couple of months. The return is not going to be great. And I'm sure they already have a pretty good understanding of which pieces they would part with from their own system. If you're going the other direction, there's 29 other teams. There's hundreds of minor league prospects. There's a lot more information to sort through. And I think that they've been working toward doing that for the last 2-3 weeks, maybe longer, probably longer, in terms of trying to figure out which teams they match up best with and try to blanket those systems.
You saw what happened post-sale. Obviously, Baltimore was having a miserable year last year. But this season, new front office. What, if anything, sounds like the difference in the way they're going about moving the remaining players they have that have some trade value?
Well, last year, the Orioles, I think it was 15 players total in the five trades they made. All but one of them was a minor leaguer, and all but one of those was, you know, a legitimate, you know, considered a prospect. But a lot of those players were in the high minors, you know, guys who had really good stats, good seasons. For all intents and purposes, the Orioles were looking at guys who had kind of popped up and saying, oh, maybe everyone missed on this guy. Maybe we're going to find something in them. Now they're not leaving a lot to chance. Even when they were trading away international bonus slots in the spring, you know, they were doing, you know, they were trading for TrackMan guys. You know, they're going down there, you know, targeting guys in, you know, the Dominican Summer League, guys that the Orioles weren't even an option to sign last year, years past, before they got into that market. So I think they're looking a lot further down the road in terms of when these guys can get there, whereas a lot of the trades they made last season, it was with the idea that if we trade, you know, for a AAA reliever from the Braves or the Yankees and in July, and we need a reliever in Baltimore in August, we could say, look at this guy we got for Zach Britton. Look at this guy we got for Kevin Gausman. That was legitimately the way they were thinking, because they're trying to show a return for it. There's not that kind of pressure this year. So I think it's going to be very different when you're looking at the types of players he can get back, especially for a player that's controllable, a Trey Mancini, a Michael Givens, Dylan Bundy even.
How much activity do you think there will be just in general?
In general, I think there always is some. Every year it's like supposed to be a quiet deadline. Every year, you know, talking about the way you guys are talking about the Diamondbacks, it could go either way. They could be a team that gets a bench bat, or they could be a team that trades 3-4 pieces. You know, that's the type of thing. Nobody accounts for that being the probability, you know, a week out. But when that happens, it ends up being a really active deadline. And then one of the teams that, you know, maybe a Diamondbacks piece goes to, one of their rivals will say, okay, well, what do we got now? And all of a sudden, it snowballs, phones start ringing, and players who weren't necessarily on the market or weren't going to have their values met, those happen late. And I think that's what's going to happen this year. It always seems to be, especially without the opportunity to add in August, I don't think, especially the amount of teams that are close to contending, I don't think there's going to be a lot of people sitting on their hands once they see other people get involved in these trades.
If, in fact, Nick, the D-backs don't sell, and most of the coverage of them has been working on that assumption that they were going to, but let's say they run through the next week at 6-1 total, what's a reasonable buy for them?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think probably the easiest would be to add a couple of bullpen arms, right? I mean, there's always a lot of inventory out there. There's always, you know, pretty the prices are usually pretty low for bullpen rentals, but I don't know. I could really see them using a starting pitcher as well. I don't know. I'm not sure how aggressive they're going to be. I think it would probably be like, you know, kind of a back-end type of guy. I think they could really use somebody to eat some innings. I think that alone would help out the bullpen a lot. So if I had to guess, I would say one of each. I would say somebody that can give them some innings at the back of the bullpen, even if it's not the highest quality innings, just bulk, and then a guy that they can, you know, feel relatively confident giving the ball to in, say, the seventh inning or eighth inning when one of their, you know, plus guys needs a day off.
Trade deadline coming up a week from tomorrow, and tomorrow on the BP show and early BP, we'll visit with Yahoo's Jeff Passan about the D-backs at the deadline. So be sure to tune in for that. All right, I'm not going to talk as much about tonight's game, but we're going to talk about Torey Lovello's day. Here's what the manager does on a daily basis. Part of early BP today. Torey, we've been spending a lot of time talking to the front office about the work that they do on a daily basis and kind of how they do it. I don't think we've ever talked to you about what your day is like. So how does your day start? When does it start when you get to the ballpark?
Yeah, I get to the ballpark anywhere between 11:45 and 12:30, and I just begin establishing those conversations and reaching out to different guys. And whether it be the coaching staff or players that are here, just sit down and start talking shop. And I go over – usually the first thing I do is I go see the coaches and I go over some of the things that happened last night that I want to see us improve upon. There's a couple things that today's game you'll see maybe a small change if the right matchup or the right situation comes up. And then I kind of hunker down at my desk and I start to develop my own game plan. It's a time when I'm once I get through the coaches and those conversations, I'm by myself. I'm by myself for about an hour and I can just map out the strategy of my day and make sure that I'm ready to for the baseball game. Once the players get here, then I want to be accessible to the players. It seems like everybody needs about 5 minutes of my time, and I just want to make sure my door's open and I'll swing in and out of my office for the next hour, hour and a half, just talking shop with some of the guys, just see how they're doing and connect with them.
I want to go back to let's start with the things that you look to the coaches to improve. What's an example of something that you may have seen in a game that you come to the coaches with that you want to adjust for the next day?
Well, I'll probably have 5 or 6 meetings a day with Darnell Coles. They're quick, easy, fast, quick moving conversations where maybe we weren't good with men in scoring position, or we didn't lead off the inning the right way. We got ahead in some counts and we started to offer some balls out of the zone. So I would cover my thoughts on that and how we could talk about it. And then I deliver a message about what my expectations are. And then he brings out directly to his coaches that are coaching under him, the other assistant and coaches that deliver to the players. And then ultimately it's something that I want to see change. I see immediate change over. So, whether it's defensive positioning or maybe the way somebody's picking up a ground ball, I'll go to Tony Perez Chica. If it has something to do with the catchers, I'll go to Robbie Hammock. Something to do with the pitchers, I'll go to Mike Butcher or Mike Fetter. So I watch the game through a different lens. I'm a coach during the game, and then I'm a teacher after.
When it comes to game planning, what are the things that you try to do to develop a game plan for that night? Because this isn't the NFL. You ain't running the first script in the first 15 plays.
Correct. I will sit around and wait for the opposing lineup, which usually gets here around 1 o'clock, 1:30. And once I get that, I start to get up some thoughts in my head about how we're going to match up, who's available. I know who's going to be available in and out of our bullpen, and how we're going to get through certain parts of the game. And I'm just projecting different thoughts about how the game may turn out. And sometimes it doesn't even come up, but I just don't want to be surprised during the game that I haven't thought something or rehearsed it or prepared for it. And then I will start to project some of our lineup and how it's going to match up against their available starters. I get a lot of different pieces of paper put on my desk. It's based on the projected availability of their players, the projected success of their players against ours, and then who's going to be available directly against that. So I start to just come up with some game plans, and I think through probably 40 or 50 different scenarios, and I'm dealing in innings and three batter or three pitcher segments, and I start to move through it that way. It gets kind of confusing, and at some point I got to get up and take a break, and that's when I start to have those conversations.
So when you get that information, obviously you've outlined your day, and because you have to touch so many different people over the course of the day, there's not time for you to sit down and research a stat packet. So when you get information, how do you digest it, and how do you trust it, knowing that you can't spend an hour and a half in front of a computer researching what Trey Mancini does against right-handed curveballs?
Correct, exactly. I have really good people built around me that give me the quickest, fastest information, and by the time it gets to me on a piece of paper, it's so dummied down you wouldn't even believe it.
I would.
Yeah, it's basically color scripted. It's got numbers on it, and I can look at it quickly and get a really quick snapshot about what it's going to look like and how it's going to shape up during the game. I could look at things over and over and over again, and I could have 4 or 5 different conclusions, but I have a great team of people around me that I really, really trust. And that didn't happen overnight. You know, when it was first thrown at us in 2017, I was a new coaching staff, it was a new front office. We had to develop a little bit of trust, and I could quickly tell that people were working extremely hard to make me look good with some of the decisions I made. Sometimes it doesn't work out, and I rely on them, and it's my decision ultimately, and I always take the blame, but there's a strategy for it, and they helped me develop that strategy.
Real quick, since those guys aren't here anymore, can you tell the story about that first game and Daniel Descalso, Jeff Mathis? Is that one you could tell?
Yeah, well, of course. Both hitters were available to me, and Mark Melanson was the pitcher, and I think it was the 8th inning, and he was one of the better setup men / closers in the game at the time. And I had something that was a fairly blinking red light that Jeff Mathis should be the hitter against Mark Melanson. If we can remember what Jeff did, he ended up doubling into the left center field gap and scoring a huge run that helped us win that game. baseball experience would tell you that Daniel Descalso, a left-handed hitter, would be the guy that would be the monster of the two. Nothing against either guy. We know how they hit, and we know that their projections are a little bit different. But you can see that you develop that trust in Mark Melancon of losing the game because of the big hit that Jeff Mathis got.
Great stuff, Tori. Go in tonight.
Thanks so much.
D-backs and Orioles coming up in just a couple of minutes for you. 6 o'clock, the BP show, 6:40, first pitch with Greg and Tom. D-backs will send Merrill Kelly to the mound against Dylan Bundy for Baltimore tonight as D-backs try to go back to 2 games over .500. They come back into play tonight. 2 games back of St. Louis in the National League Wild Card race. All right, thanks for joining us for Early BP.